and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look back at the story in the news that defined the struggle between the better angels of our nature and the emerging dark side of America that exploded into the open this year in Charlottesville, Virginia. We'll begin with a broadcast of Background Briefing from August the 21st, 2017, in which we offered insight into a new radical movement, Antifa, that has become the nemesis of the alt-right, who, along with the Fox echo chamber, have exaggerated the power and influence of a small group fighting back against well-funded right-wing provocateurs on campus and Nazis attacking and murdering citizens as they did in Charlottesville, Virginia. Mark Bray, an historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalism in modern Europe, who was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street, joined us to discuss his latest book, Antifa, an anti-fascist handbook. We examined the rise of white supremacy and neo-Nazism around the world following recent demonstrations in Warsaw, Poland, and surveyed the history of anti-fascism from its origins to the present day. While critics say shutting down adversaries is anti-democratic, Antifa activists argue that the horrors of fascism must never be allowed to triumph again, especially with Donald Trump in the White House, who is enacting his authoritarian tendencies at home while displaying affection and solidarity with despots abroad. Then we'll go to a broadcast of Background Briefing from August the 24th, 2017, analyzing the emergence of the alt-right in Trump's America with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest, about his latest book, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. We discussed Trump's alarming response to the recent disgrace of neo-Nazis descending on Thomas Jefferson's hometown and Jefferson's warning that an ignorant people cannot remain a free people in the context of a failing education system and growing civic ignorance compounded by social media that has given rise to our Kardashian culture. And joining us now is Mark Bray, who's an historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalism in modern Europe, who was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street and is a visiting lecturer at Dartmouth College. He's the author of Translating Anarchy, The Anarchism of Occupy Wall Street, and his latest book just out is Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Bray.
Thank you for having me.
And the Antifa apocalypse didn't happen in the way that the right wing had built this up and even talked about the Antifa super soldiers that would create a civil war in the United States on November the 4th, what, a couple of Saturdays ago. So is this a problem in terms of any political organization in the United States, that we are so much a culture that is motivated by Manichaeanism? Because it seems to me that the right in this country have all the money, have all these bilious billionaires supporting them, like David Horowitz, and we know that Stephen Bannon gets supported by the Mercers, etc. And yet they have to frame themselves as being beleaguered and
right,
up against this huge tide of socialist or Sharia takeover of the country. So
right,
let's begin with that kind of context. Are we sort of hopelessly Manichaean?
Well, I think you're certainly right that the way that these fascist and white supremacist and alt-right groups portray themselves as the really the ultimate victim, the kinds of privileges of being, you know, the patriarchal white male Christian conservative that have been eaten away by generations of social struggle. These identities are beleaguered, and they're trying to mischaracterize movements for feminism or queer and trans liberation or racial justice in order to portray themselves as the ones who are being under attack. This erroneous notion of white genocide, for example, and the irony is that they are trying to re-instantiate the kinds of domination that these movements have been fighting against, and there is a kind of Manichaean perspective that they're trying to put forward, but I think that really, regardless of people's politics or perspectives, I think there's room for all people in all walks of life to denounce fascist and white supremacist perspectives, and that really they are far outside of what most people think.
Well, but I think they've gotten even scarier because they're no longer these tattooed skinheads on motorbikes. They all look like accountants now and business managers. They've, you know, this guy Spencer wears business suits and looks like a junior corporate executive.
Right, right. I mean, certainly there's an effort to take a page out of the French New Right and out of the page of those who have come before, like David Duke, who tried to segue from being in Klan robes to being to wearing a suit in office to try and present a kind of quote-unquote respectable, middle-class, educated perspective on what they're trying to sort of rebrand as white nationalism, even though it's really basically just a wrinkle on traditional white supremacist perspectives. And I think that that really gives some insight into how fascist and white supremacist politics try to grow by making their perspectives seem everyday and family-friendly and innocuous, and why it's so important to protest these groups and to prevent these ideas from becoming normalized. And so certainly the tiki torch-wielding, khaki-wearing neo-Nazis that showed up in Virginia are a really strong example of that. Also, anti-racist researchers have pointed out that these groups and individuals do also have connections to your sort of stereotypical skinhead neo-Nazi kind of biker milieu as well. So it's sort of more of a continuity in that way.
Well, since you've studied human rights terrorism and political radicalization in modern Europe, what did you make of the demonstrations that took place the weekend before last in Warsaw, Poland? 60,000-plus people showed up. It was a massive demonstration. And they were talking about clean blood and white Europe, and even chanting Sieg Heil in a country where the worst Nazi atrocities were committed.
Right, yeah. I visited Poland 3 or 4 years ago and visited a lot of the sites of the former ghettos, and it was really appalling to see all the white supremacist graffiti that was still scrolled across these walls. Certainly, there's a struggle going on across Europe for the kind of soul of what this region will look like in the future. Will it become multicultural? Will it become multi-religious? Will it welcome in immigrants and refugees and Muslims and so forth? Or will it try to turn back the tide to an imagined purity that never really existed? Certainly this is especially violent and especially dangerous in parts of Eastern Europe, parts of the Balkans, but it is a problem that stretches across the continent, and groups from all different countries were there. Richard Spencer, I think, planned, I read, to show up, but the Polish authorities wouldn't let him into the country. So, you know, the struggles of the 30s and 40s may seem distant, but there are places where it's very real, and I think that's why we really need to take this threat seriously.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Bray, who's an historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalization in modern Europe, who was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street and is a visiting lecturer at Dartmouth College. He's the author of Translating Anarchy, The Anarchism of Occupy Wall Street, and his latest book just out is Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. It is a bit ironic, though, isn't it, Mark, that the victims of fascism in the 30s and 40s, the Jewish diaspora, along with, of course, the gypsies and infirm people, etc. But nowadays, it seems that even though they're still anti-Semitic, they seem to be more anti-Muslim than anything. That seems to animate the European fascists.
Right, right. And it's indicative of shifts over time. We can see even that when the far right reemerged in Europe in the 40s and 50s and 60s, there was a shift towards focusing on anti-Semitism, towards focusing on new waves of migration from the Caribbean, from South Asia, from Turkey in the case of Germany. And so, far-right politics, fascist politics have a kind of flexibility in terms of finding who the other is that will be the reflection of their argument that they represent the true nation or the true race. And at the moment, they're trying to tap into fears about terrorism, fears about outsiders and refugees and immigrants, and also in some cases, in some really bizarre ways, trying to tap into a kind of progressive animal rights perspective by trying to do anti-halal events under the guise of being pro-animal rights, or pro-LGBTQ perspectives by trying to demonize Muslims as allegedly being homophobic. And so I think it really shows how we need to have all of our politics in conversation with each other and be intersectional and holistic and not just let one issue stand in for the whole.
Well, let's talk about your handbook. Now, to get a perspective on the handbook, it does make sense to sort of do a quick sort of sketch of the history of anti-fascism. Obviously, the fascists were triumphant in the Spanish Civil War in Italy, and then in Germany, and piled up, 50, 60 million corpses in their wake until they were finally defeated. But all along, there were anti-fascists. Of course, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade of American idealists on the left were often referred to as premature anti-fascists. So just begin, if you will, at the beginning of this rather largely untold story.
Right, right. So when fascism emerged, it emerged as, among other things, a violent reaction, a wave of revolutionary upheaval in Italy, in Germany, and elsewhere. And so fascists who claimed to be acting in the interest of the Italian nation, for example, were confronted by militant anti-fascists in a formation called the Arditi del Popolo, which included anarchists and communists and socialists and all kinds of leftists. Likewise, in Germany, the communists and socialists formed groups that fought back against the Nazis. But it's interesting that really when Hitler took power in 1933, communist and socialist leadership didn't realize how dangerous of a threat it was. And so your reference to the Spanish Civil War is very important because that's really the first moment that the European left as a whole and arguably the global left really realized that they were in a struggle for existence against an enemy that wanted to destroy them completely. What people don't realize, though, is that after Hitler, Mussolini, and so forth were defeated in World War II, the far right in Europe slumbered, and it came out of hiding gradually over the course of the following decades, as we discussed, trying to tap into xenophobic and anti-immigrant perspectives, more recently anti-Muslim perspectives. And there's also been an effort to try and distance the rhetoric from the explicit fascist and Nazi past, even though there are documented lineages between them and the National Front, for example, in France and in other groups, and try to present this respectable party politics image, which has raised interesting questions for resistance and how to push back when these groups are tapping into large-scale frustrations with the prevailing left parties or with the welfare state.
But in terms of the political spectrum, Antifa and anarchists are often conflated as being on the left. And if you talk about the Spanish Civil War, I recall from reading George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia that the anarchists were being persecuted and killed as much by Stalin's people as they were by Franco's fascists.
That's entirely correct, yeah. So part of the tragedy of the 20s, 30s, and 40s is that most of the European left could not actually successfully get on the same page to fight the common enemy. There was a brief window of time in the beginning of the Spanish Civil War when it seemed like all of the left groups were united, but what happened very quickly was the left unity fragmented into, largely speaking, two coalitions. One were the anarchists, Trotskyists, George Orwell, and his comrades, who were in favor of pursuing a social revolution in addition to fighting the war, and then that pitted them against the Stalinists and their allies, who were in favor of essentially returning the upper class to their position, putting off the class struggle in the interest of fighting the civil war, as they phrased it. And essentially, it was a way for Stalinists to pursue Trotskyists and anarchists and any kind of dissident socialists, and they were really much more preoccupied on that goal than fighting the war. There's been some interesting documents that uncovered over the years about how Stalin was really much more interested in this internal left struggle than fighting the war. So it's a tragic history, and that's why post-war anti-fascists have done what they can, not always successfully, to try and put differences aside, recognizing that there is a threat that faces all of us.
Let's take a brief station break. We're back continuing the conversation.
Taylor. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one thing I know. Poll tax and Jim Crow and greed have got to go. You're bound to lose.
Welcome back. We are continuing the conversation with Mark Bray, who's an historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalism in modern Europe. He was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street and is a visiting lecturer at Dartmouth College. He's the author of Translating Anarchy, The Anarchism of Occupy Wall Street. And his latest book just out is Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. Well, let's move to the Antifa and of course, your new book, Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. And I suppose most people in the audience and in the country first heard of Antifa as a result of what happened in Charlottesville. I think that's pretty much when it sort of first emerged as a phenomenon. And I recall at the time, or shortly thereafter, talking to a couple of Jewish students. They were in yeshiva school, and they were in linking arms with Dr. Cornel West and others. And the police basically were hands off. They let the fascists, you know, chanting blood and soil and Jews will not replace us, except they literally had a phalanx of these fascists moving on them, and they were totally vulnerable. And this yeshiva student that I interviewed said, you know, we were saved by Antifa. So that gets to the heart of it, doesn't it? That, you know, you can't basically lock hands and sing kumbaya to these thugs who have guns and clubs and will beat the hell out of you.
Yeah, I mean, there is no one-size-fits-all way to organize against the far right, and I think there's a wide variety of strategies and tactics that listeners can turn to try and make a difference. But it is true that when you counter-protest white supremacists and fascists, there's a very good chance that they're going to be violent against you, and you need to be ready for that. And so that's partly the anti-fascist perspective, is to be ready for that and to really make an argument that it's not a question of if white supremacists and fascist groups will be violent. It's a question of when. And if we don't take it seriously from the very start, we'll run the risk of letting these groups grow to the point where their violent perspectives are normalized, everyday people pick them up, and marginalized populations feel the brunt of that in a way that often mainstream society is not as attuned to and looks the other way. And so that's really sort of the crux of the politics, and certainly the statements made by Cornel West and other clergy and some of the students you mentioned that anti-fascists really saved them from violent neo-Nazis in Charlottesville, I think gets to the core of what this is about.
Well, obviously, the way that it's that Donald Trump himself tried to say there were good peoples on both sides and use the Antifa as an excuse for, I think, his essentially covert sympathy for the right and for his own authoritarian tendencies. But the press also, to my mind, plays a role in basically equating Antifa with the Nazis. And I think it probably comes out of this binary convention in our press that in the universe of discourse, there's two equal and opposite opinions. You know, the black and white idea, if you talk to a Republican, you have to talk to a Democrat. If you talk, you know, the reductio absurdum is if you talk to a Holocaust survivor, you have to talk to a Holocaust denier. But it has enabled creationism to be equated with evolution, and it's allowed the denial of global warming, faux science, to be equated with real science. So it is something that bothers me as a journalist, coming out of a different tradition, you know, from the BBC, for example, where you don't have to pretend that you're the piano player in the whorehouse. You try to be as fair as possible, but there's no point in hiding who you are. That's dishonest.
Right. And so certainly the media narrative covering fascism and anti-fascism from perhaps the counter-protest against Milo Yiannopoulos at Berkeley back in February up through Trump's comments about good people on both sides were that essentially the both sides were equivalent. It was a focus that refuse to actually focus on the values and politics and histories and context that underpin why fascists are violent and why anti-fascists feel compelled to defend themselves. Then there was, of course, a brief window of time when the media pushed back against Trump's moral equivalency, and you had figures like Mitt Romney and so forth saying there is no moral equivalency, but then the media cycle needed a new hot take, and then there were articles that came out saying, yes, there is a moral equivalency, there are bad people on both sides. Ultimately, what I try to emphasize is no action can be evaluated in the absence of its motivations and its consequences and its history. And so people can agree or disagree about the ethical status of self-defense, the efficacy of confronting and counter-protesting these groups, but to say that the kind of self-defense, for example, of the anti-fascists in Charlottesville was of the same variety as the fascists who were trying to attack black people and Jews and so forth is really absurd. And as you said, it's that kind of journalistic neutrality where journalists feel emboldened to be normatively descriptive about politics that are outside of the norm, especially on the left, but often treat the right with kid gloves. So it's very disturbing, and certainly the media have done a poor job covering this for the reasons we mentioned, and also for the kind of really lack of foundational information on what anti-fascism is.
But, of course, the demonstrations that took place at the inauguration in the streets of Washington, I watched those in real time as they were filmed, and I don't think there's any way that you can suggest that the average American didn't think that that was pretty appalling behavior.
Certainly right. It was an unpopular action that most Americans don't understand or agree with. But I think, if I could try to play devil's advocate and do my best to explain the perspective as I understand it of the organizers, it was to say that if you have someone walking into the White House who many people say is a fascist or is fascistic, whose actions will inevitably result in death from people losing their health insurance, destruction of the planet, and so forth, then certainly the way that we protest and the way that we resist should correspondingly be elevated. We should pull the emergency brake. We should make it clear that this is a crisis. To me, that was part of the motivation of the people who committed targeted property destruction. But returning to our previous conversation, certainly I think there's a world of difference between breaking window panes versus breaking people's bones. And that's certainly an important thing to keep in mind. And not that you are going down the road of moral equivalency, but some people do.
Well, so can you break the movement down, Antifa, into a defensive movement or an offensive movement? Is it possible to be defensive and not offensive?
Good question. So based on my research, and the book is based on interviews with approximately 60 anti-fascists from 17 different countries in Europe and North America, the perspective, as I understand it, is understanding self-defense in two ways. One, in an immediate sense, which is more common sense, that in every era of anti-fascist organizing, groups and movements have grown in response to violent neo-Nazi groups and skinhead groups and so forth. So self-defense in an immediate sense. But also many put forward a perspective of self-defense in a preemptive sense, which is, returning to a conversation we had earlier, refusing to accept the proposition that white supremacist or fascist organizing can happen in the absence of violence. It's an argument that it's only a matter of when, not if, and for stopping these groups before they grow. That having been said, though, the perspective that I got from my interview subjects was that most of the time they accomplish this through nonviolent methods, by figuring out through research where far-right groups are going to have their events, contacting venue owners to shut them down, finding out what web servers host websites for the far-right, and pressuring them to ban them, and that happened quite successfully after Charlottesville, where a lot of web servers got rid of these neo-Nazi sites based on public pressure. But sometimes it entails counter-protesting and sometimes confronting these far-right groups and being ready for the violence that inevitably comes through. And so that kind of preemptive self-defense is a kind of paradox that some people struggle with. But I think if we think through the historical ramifications of where these politics lead, if they're allowed to flourish, I think that's the kind of context that's necessary to understand where anti-fascists are coming from.
But in terms of the Antifa tactic known as no platforming, which is to deny these alt-right fascists their opportunity to speak in public, and we've seen that on campuses, particularly at Berkeley and also down in Florida recently. I've spoke with Erwin Chemerinsky at the time. He's a dean of the law school at Berkeley. And what bothered him, it wasn't so much Antifa, it's the tactics of the David Horowitzes and the Milo Yiannopouloses and Breitbart and Bannon, etc., that essentially what they're all about is seeking publicity and, more importantly, seeking martyrdom, going back to our original discussion, or the beginning of our discussion, and that is that the right has to have this kind of martyrdom complex, even though they're all funded by billionaires and basically are extorting attention in a form of terrorism. But their real tactic, at least this is what Irwin was saying, is to basically bankrupt the public education. I mean, that they are causing these public universities to spend an enormous amount of money, but their real hope is that they will be banned. Then they can become martyrs. So how much is Antifa paying into that, in the sense that these right-wing groups really want is to be banned from speaking on campuses so that they can say, see, we're martyrs of free speech and the left are a bunch of, you know, they're censoring us. Political correctness is the scourge that's overtaking America.
Right. Well, I think that fascists and white supremacists and alt-right provocateurs certainly thrive to be the victim, and they'll be the victim no matter what happens. And so certainly you're right to touch upon the question of political correctness, and that has an especially important relevance in the context of the university. So, you know, in a classroom when a professor insists on feminist discourses, on using the pronouns that students choose, pushing back against kind of racist statements in classrooms, these feminist and anti-racist and queer and trans liberation perspectives are the kind of fundamental battleground that the far right feels like they are being excluded from. But of course, it's really just them crying about the loss of their traditional privileges and forms of domination. When it comes to tactics, I think that it's important to understand that far right movements grow not entirely dissimilarly from how left movements grow. You need to have public events, you need to embed movements in communities, you need to disseminate messages, you need to become normalized, you have to have your perspectives become common sense. And by preventing these individuals and groups from having their events, I think it may, in the short term, give them more public attention. But in the long run, I think it short circuits their ability to translate that into a movement and into a kind of establishment or institution in society. So even if you take the case of Milo, certainly he got a lot of attention when he was shut down in Berkeley, but subsequently a lot of universities have used the excuse of the kind of protester, counter-protester chaos to try and ban him on considerations of security. When Milo tried to have an event in Arizona, he contacted 62 different venues who all refused him because they didn't want to deal with it. Overall, the attention brought up his pro-pedophilia comments. He was hired by the Daily Caller for one day before he was fired because even at the far-right Daily Caller, his presence was untenable. And so in that way, I think that these kinds of protest tactics and movements may generate some attention in the short term, but over time, it's a diminishing marginal return. And on the other side, we're building a strong anti-racist movement that is ready to use direct action methods to prevent these groups from growing. So I think that it's important. Let's check in on figures like Milo, Richard Spencer, the prospects of the far right, 6 months from now, a year from now, and I'm optimistic that their ability to actually translate these heinous ideas into popular movements will not be able to advance.
Let's talk a little bit about what you refer to as liberal anti-fascism, and that, I think, is a part of a broader issue of the idea from the Gospel of St. John that you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free, which is, I think, the sort of trap. I know George Lakoff at Berkeley talks about this in terms of the way the right is very effective at framing arguments, whereas the left is always very deficient in that regard. And that the assumption is that if you have the most reasonable argument, you therefore win. And that is not working in this post-truth America we have, where there is no consensus about what is true and what is real anymore. And that is a scary fact. So you have so many people living inside the Fox, Breitbart, Sinclair, Limbaugh bubble, and Trump tells them that to believe him, and which they do, and that everything else is fake news. So there seems to be a sort of a connection there, in as much as, you know, How do you get beyond the idea that by simply being reasonable and having the best source intellectual argument, that somehow, I mean, I know it's a, this is a vestige of the Age of Enlightenment, but it's not working. And I struggle with that because I wish there was a way to prick the Fox, Breitbart, Sinclair bubble and get to these people, because they're all being conned by this total fraud that they voted for, Donald Trump.
Right, right. So certainly you're right to trace this to Enlightenment thinking in the perspective that in an open confrontation, truth will always defeat error. But that kind of modernist optimism, I think, was never really grounded in reality and was, I think, largely shattered by the kind of events of that we're really talking about, the Holocaust, World War II, the perspective that things don't always get better. Certainly, I think that discourse and argumentation are super important. It's super important to have conversations like this and to try and convince people of the righteousness of being anti-racist and feminist and so forth. But I think that any kind of discourse operates in the context of power and the ability to push back against far-right movements and to really build successful popular movements to build a better world rely on meeting people's needs, recognizing how in times of economic crisis they're going to look for solutions, and if their needs aren't met by the left, they aren't met by labor unions or by working in their communities, they're going to blame immigrants, they're going to turn to demagogues who are going to promise to reverse the entire tide of neoliberalism by bringing jobs back to the United States, which is impossible. And so I think it's important to kind of think of a multi-tiered, multi-layered strategy that includes argumentation, includes discourse and rationality, but also incorporates organizing, building bridges in communities, and trying to build a better world. And when it comes to dealing with the far right, certainly I think we can see even in the presidential election that at a sort of mainstream level, the right kinds of arguments were made about why Donald Trump was full of it, but nevertheless, a lot of people supported him anyway, and he ended up winning the election. So I don't think it's enough to simply make the argument. It's also important to figure out why people are hurting, organize to try to make a better world, and for people who simply aren't going to respond to that, try to prevent far-right and racist ideas from taking the mainstream position, and that entails organizing. It entails getting out there. That's been true in the past. It's true today, and it's why we need to really take a holistic look at this, I'd say.
Well, Mark Bray, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Bray, who's an historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalism in modern Europe, who was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street and is a visiting lecturer at Dartmouth College. He's the author of Translating Anarchy, The Anarchism of Occupy Wall Street, and his latest book just out is Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. And that was from Background Briefing, August the 21st, 2017. We'll take a brief break, then be back with more Background Briefing's alt-right coverage from 2017 with an interview on August the 24th on the emergence of the alt-right in Trump's America.